Good morning, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich at 5 with the opening bell and Steve Cochran at 6. It is Monday. That means it's the Monday morning movie reviews. And, of course, my dad will call in to tell a joke because it's a jokey time and much more. Our phone number is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200 for talk and text. And you can check us out on Twitter. Best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page, facebook.com/NickDShow. That familiar theme that you heard means it's time for the Monday morning movie reviews. Every Monday morning, Eric Childress and Colin Suter from efilmcritic.com, rogerebert.com, and more. Join me to talk about the latest releases for the week, and we'll talk about box office with Eric as well. And let's welcome Eric. Hello, Eric.
Hello.
And Colin. Hello, Colin.
Hello there.
All right. Once again, let's, Eric, another mention for you guys are getting, it's getting exciting because Friday, the fourth annual Chicago Critics Film Festival at the Music Box starts. And why don't you, Eric, again, give everybody the information on what they can, you know, where they can get tickets and all that.
Right. Well, at the music, as just mentioned, at the Music Box Theater, starting this Friday night, with the fourth annual Chicago Critics Film Festival kicks off. If you go to ChicagoCriticsFilmFestival.com, you can see the entire schedule there, as well as links to buy tickets to all the films. You can also go to the MusicBoxTheater.com website to do that as well. And we're just really excited. Ticket sales are starting to go up. People are really starting to really heat up traffic around our sites and whatnot. And we're hope that they'll be coming out because Craig Robinson and Chad Hartigan will be here Friday night, and then Saturday we have a huge day of guests, including Adam Pally will be back for a 5 o'clock screen of the film Joshi from Sundance. 7 o'clock, Michael Pena is going to be here with War on Everyone, the new John Michael McDonough film. And then at 9:30, we're going to have the director Patricia Rosema, who directed Into the Forest, the new apocalyptic movie with Ellen Page and Evan Rachel Wood. And that's just Friday and Saturday.
Wow.
So we're going to have Ira Sachs here on Sunday night. Ty West is going to be here the following Wednesday. Martin Starr, for you Silicon Valley and Freaks and Geeks fans, will be here on closing night. If you're an Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt fan, Dylan Galula, who played Jane Krakowski's daughter on season one, is also going to be here part of closing night with a film called First Girl I Loved. And Colin's got his shorts programs with some special guests coming in as well.
All right, Colin, tell us a little bit about what's happening with the shorts.
The shorts programs. The first one is Saturday at 1 p.m. And that's a fantastic block. We got a short film by Danny DeVito in it. It's called Curmudgeons. He directed it too. A great movie called Peacock from Sweden that is just one of the best films I've seen this year, long or short. And my special guests are Jocelyn DeBoer and Dawn Lube. Jocelyn has been at our festival before. She was in Dead Snow 2, Red versus Dead. She was the big Star Wars fan. And she and Dawn Lube directed this, or not directed, but they wrote and starred in this very dark sort of Stepford Wives-ish comedy called Greener Grass that is just one of the most bizarre and wonderfully weird comedies I've ever booked for this thing. And a movie called Voyagers, a short film called Voyagers that is going to look amazing on the big screen. And I also have, in this block, a movie called Bajo Las Brosas, which means Beneath the Embers. And it's a documentary, and I got the cinematographer for this movie flying in from Mexico to be here. So that should be interesting as well. So it's a really eclectic lineup. And then Monday at 5:30, no guests, but some really terrific films, a couple documentaries. One is called The Send Off, about a prom in this sort of economically depressed town. And another movie called Love Bite, which is about this artist named Lori Lipton, who does these amazingly intricate, insane, beautiful pencil. She's a pencil artist. She does these large murals all out of just regular pencil. That movie features Terry Gilliam, giving his two cents on her work. Just a movie called Killer that I think is definitely for fans of Todd Solondz's work. I can't really say what it's about, but it's about sexual discovery and death. And what happens at the end of this movie, I can't wait to hear the audience reaction to it. it's pretty hilarious and uncomfortable and weird. So those are my two shorts programs. We also got a couple of great short films playing before features. One of which is a movie called Nuts, that's the name of the feature, this film called Nuts. That is playing on, Tuesday at 3:30. Tuesday at 3:30, and it's paired up with a short film called Glove. These two films are kind of a match made in heaven. They're both sort of these animated documentary films that are, just about these kind of weird moments in history. That's a real treat, that double billing right there. I'm really excited. This is going to be a great lineup, a great week. And we've been pitching it all day at the Chicago Cultural Center. we're pretty excited about who's coming and everything.
Great.
So.
Great. And you can get tickets at the Music Box website and ChicagoCriticsFilmFestival.com.
That's right.
All right. And it starts this Friday, and it's the 20th through the 26th at the beautiful Music Box Theater. You can check out the full schedule at musicboxtheater.com and at ChicagoCriticsFilmFestival.com as well. All right. Very exciting. Very, very exciting. Okay. We got some new movies to talk about. So none of you guys, I'm taking a bullet this week. You guys did not see The Darkness.
No.
Okay. Nope. All right. Well, all right. I did. The Darkness is the latest film from a director who I like, actually, Greg McLean. He directed Wolf Creek, which is a brutal and awesome movie that came out about 10 years ago. He also directed Rogue, which is an alligator movie. And it's interesting how it just seems in some sort of way his career is kind of mimicking Toby Hooper's. In a weird way, because he did Wolf Creek, which is, like a Texas Chainsaw Massacre, based on a real life event, but it takes place in the Australian outback. And then he did Wolf Creek 2 years later and made that movie even crazier and over the top, just like Toby Hooper did with Texas Chainsaw 2. And then his follow up is an alligator movie like Toby Hooper did when he made Eaten Alive.
Yeah.
And now he made Poltergeist. So it's essentially what this guy has made. He did skip Life Force, which is unfortunate, but anyway, so this is like his Poltergeist, and it is all the way down to Native Burial Ground, spirits and sort of spirit expert, exorcist expert. What happens is that the family led by Kevin Bacon and Rhoda Mitchell, they go to the Grand Canyon on a vacation, and their youngest boy is autistic. And he goes to like a burial ground and takes some stones. And with the stones that he brings back home, they bring some spirits that start screwing around in the house and doing some crazy stuff. That's essentially the plot. The subplots include the mom's an alcoholic. The dad is completely disturbed. And the only person that kind of makes sense in the family is the kid who has autism. And it's weirdly and kind of horribly portrayed in the movie as some sort of like magic, it's like the kid with the illness or the condition is like somehow magical. Do you know what I mean?
Which is like Dreamcatcher.
Except
uh-huh.
Yeah, but I love Dreamcatcher anyway. Uh-huh. It's funny to watch Kevin Bacon and Rhoda Mitchell actually kind of act in this movie, despite the fact that the script is really terrible. There's nothing that you haven't seen in this movie before. There are spirits that leave footprints and handprints like in charcoal all over bedsheets and faces and stuff like that. It is PG-13. And this is a director who has kind of gone out of his way, at least in three of his movies, to push the envelope in the world of R-rated movies. And he just seems to be coasting here. You know, it's a studio project. It's maybe it'll get him some work, and he can go back to doing the rough and tumble stuff that he does in the R-rated world. But this is a this has been done a million times before. It's not scary, and it is it's your typical PG-13 ghost movie, and nothing new is added. Not one moment of it is inspired. I was bored with it a half an hour in, and it's just a bad PG-13. Horror film, and this has been, has this movie been sitting around for a while and it just got released? Is that the deal?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, the studio that released it is the same studio that picked up The Green Inferno.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was sitting around for a couple of years. So I don't know for certain if this is just another one of their pickups, because they've never released, until Green Inferno, really never released anything
right.
of any really note, you know, sort of something that would garner a wide release.
Yeah.
So it's possible that they're just, you know, picking up crumbs along the way.
Yeah, well, it feels like it's a movie that you know, had, like, issues. And the kid who's in it, and Dan, you watch Gotham, right?
Yeah, occasionally.
The kid who's in it, who plays the autistic kid, I think he plays Bruce Wayne as a kid in Gotham.
That makes sense, yeah.
It's the same kid. And is he good on Gotham?
He's all right.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, they don't give much to do. It's not really about him at this point.
Right. Okay. Well, anyway, I just thought that was an interesting credit. And you know, so no, not a good movie. PG-13, boring ghost nonsense. And so don't see it. You guys were lucky that you skipped it. Okay.
Okay.
All right, Eric and Colin, hang on, guys.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back from the news, after the news, we'll come back and talk about some more new movies. And we'll talk about the box office as well. It's the Monday Morning Movie Reviews, Eric, Colin, and Nick. And that's all coming up right after the break here and the news on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on a Monday morning. And that means it's the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. Got lots of movies to talk about this week, plus box office, some impressive numbers happening in the world of Marvel, which is comes as no surprise. Yeah. So our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. 312-981-7200. We will also, you can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and Facebook.com/Nick D Show. Like us there. And let's welcome Eric and Colin back. Welcome back, guys.
Hello.
All right. Eric.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell us about Being Charlie? I'm very, very, very curious about this movie.
Yeah, okay. Well, this is the new film from Rob Reiner, which is a statement that has not bode well for the last two decades, pretty much.
Yeah.
But this one has a sort of a unique personal touch to it in that it was co-written by his son, Nick, and it's sort of a semi-autobiographical take on his drug addiction and the problems that his family has had with him. So this is, you know, sort of a coming out party, sort of an airing of grievances in a way. And it stars Nick Robinson, who was one of the kids being chased in Jurassic World. And he stars as Charlie, essentially playing the Nick Reiner character. And as the film opens, he's clearly already well into his addiction problem. And his father's, played by Cary Elwes, is running for state senator or governor or something. He's running for some political office. So there's some clearly concerns about what the public might not know, you know, knowing stuff about his son's addiction might do to his campaign. So his parents, mostly his mom, obviously very concerned about his well-being and do their best to try to get him to stick in a rehab program. And one thing goes bad, and then he has to eventually either commit to, you know, doing rehab or be put in jail. So this begins a pretty familiar tale of addiction and stints in rehab and whatnot. And when this film kind of sticks to that aspect of it and really just kind of quietly goes about its business, it's really nothing, anything new, but at least you get a sense that Rob Reiner really has kind of a personal stake in this movie and treats it with not so much kid gloves, but when he's just sort of staying out of the way and not really directing too much, you really get a sense that this movie might have become something better. Unfortunately, it just doesn't, because it doesn't take sort of any kind of documentary-like approach to this material. It still is very, very much scripted drama. And any time Elvis and his father comes into play, it really, really continues to take left turns at any time he shows up. The scenes involving the father's political campaign never really work. The relationship between him and his son never feels authentic in any way. It really feels like really poorly scripted drama. Then there are moments here and there weaved in between during his stint in rehab and then out of rehab. He has another friend of his that kind of looks out for him, but also has some drug issues of himself. He meets a girl in rehab who's played by Morgan Saylor, who is probably most known to audiences as the daughter on Homeland the first couple seasons, Damian Lewis's daughter. Mm-hmm. I thought she was pretty not good on Homeland, and she was also in a film at Sundance this year called White Girl that she starred in. She was pretty terrible in that, and she's pretty terrible in this too. So the scenes between them are not particularly convincing, and she just kind of leaves the story at some point and is never really heard from again. So it's certainly not a film that I can recommend, but as Rob Reiner films go, you can at least sense that he's trying something different here. And, I don't want to go so far as to use the word admirable. It's obviously a very personal story to him, but he's not doing these stories like Magic of Belle Isle or whatever some of these other movies that he's done recently.
Man, I'm looking at his filmography right now, man.
What else is he? I mean, there was the one with the kids that Colin, you saw that one?
Flipped.
Oh, yeah. Flipped, yeah.
Okay. And So It Goes, which was Michael Douglas.
And Diane Keaton.
The Magic of Belle Isle, Flipped, The Bucket List.
The Bucket List was the most evil film ever made.
Rumor Has It with Jennifer Aniston and Kevin Costner. Alex and Emma with Kate Hudson and Luke Wilson. The Story of Us with Bruce Willis
and
Michelle Pfeiffer.
Yeah.
Ghosts of Mississippi. We're going back to 1996 now.
Yeah.
Which is a film I didn't like. The last movie that he made, one of the best movies he's ever made, that was any good, came out in 1995, and that's The American President.
Yes.
And it's one of the best movies he's ever made, if not the best movie he's ever made.
Yeah, unquestionably.
Yeah.
Based on that list,
man,
I could probably say Being Charlie is maybe the best movie he's made since Ghost of Mississippi. Not saying much.
No, it's not.
But, if we're ranking Rob Reiner films since post-1995, it's the second best one.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Boy, what a dry spell. And his next movie is...
That's more than a dry spell.
Yeah, no, that's terrible. His next movie is LBJ.
Okay.
And I guess it's about... let's see what this is. It's about Lyndon Baines Johnson from his young days.
He got one coming out on HBO.
Yep. Mm. Yep. It's coming out next week.
Yeah.
It's going to be on HBO next week. Young Days in West Texas to the White House. Jennifer Jason Leigh, Woody Harrelson, and Bill Pullman are your cast members.
Okay, you got a cast.
So I'm guessing Woody Harrelson is going to play LBJ?
I think I've heard that, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, anyway, there you go. All right. Obviously, I was just really interested because is it a lower budget thing, this movie, too?
Yeah, absolutely. It's put out by a small company called Paladin and whatnot. It premiered at Toronto last year, the reviews weren't particularly good then.
You know, he came here to GN, got interviewed here, and he really worked the circuit. I mean, he's really promoting this movie.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, it's too bad it's not as good as it should have been. So,
right.
Okay. Well, that's Being Charlie, which is out right now. Now, let me ask this: Have either of you guys seen The Family Fang?
I have.
Oh, okay.
I saw that at Toronto last year as well.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll get to that one in a little bit. First, you guys are going to handle a bigger splash, which I have not seen, and I'm really curious about it because the cast is pretty amazing. So, Colin, why don't you tell us about A Bigger Splash?
All right. Well, this stars Tilda Swinton as a world-famous rock star who is losing her voice. She and her boyfriend, who's a filmmaker, played by, I'm going to mispronounce the heck out of this, but it's Matthias Schoenaerts.
Yeah. That's close enough.
Yeah. Okay. They go off on a vacation to a little island in Italy, and they're disrupted by an old friend of hers, played by Ralph Fiennes, and his teenage daughter, played by Dakota Johnson. Fiennes' character is a
brash. He's a little obnoxious. He was, you know, with her in her early days on her rise to the top. And he's a little too hands-on with his own daughter, who is starting to get attracted to Tilda Swinton's boyfriend. Meanwhile, the attraction that once existed between Tilda Swinton and Ralph Fiennes starts to resurface. So it's one of these films where there aren't many characters, but everyone is hiding something. And the movie, it takes its time to set up these relationships and setting up the tension, it eventually starts to get out of hand, as, you know, particularly in the third act, which I kind of suspected it would. But what's sort of, there's some weird things about this film. it's kind of a slow, like I said, it's kind of a slow build up to what happens in the third act. It starts out, I think, as interesting enough character study, these four characters. You know, it has a kind of a loose improvisational feel to a lot of it. Ralph Fiennes is having, you know, fun with his character. He gets naked a lot. Everybody in this movie gets naked a lot, first of all. So there's that. But once it gets to this point in the third act where it stops being about really just the characters and more about this situation, it's kind of where the movie, I think, falls apart. It kind of gets into this conventional territory that really doesn't amount to much, and by the end of time it's over, I'm kind of left wondering, you know, well, what was I supposed to get out of this? You know, what am I supposed to think of these characters? I'm not really sure what the whole point of this whole thing was. Not only that, but I really wanted to hear Tilda Swinton's music and, you know, what genre she was even. There's just one shot of her in a stadium, you know, being, you know, cheered at, and she's got like David Bowie makeup on and everything, and, you know, but we never get to hear a note of her music, which I was kind of disappointed in. So I don't know. It's a strange film, but by the end, it kind of made me feel empty, in spite of, you know, the performances, which are pretty darn good across the board. And an interesting build up, but by the end, it just, you know, kind of fell flat for me.
Okay. All right. Eric, hang on. Colin, hang on. We got to take a break. We'll find out what Eric thought of A Bigger Splash after we take a break here on 720 WGN. The movie reviews continue on this Monday morning on GN. Welcome back, everybody. Yeah. Monday morning movie reviews continue. Colin Suter, Eric Childress, and myself. Check them out at efilmcritic.com, rogerebert.com. Be sure to get your tickets for the Chicago Critics Film Festival, which begins Friday the 20th and goes through the 26th at the Music Box Theater. You can get a full schedule and tickets at themusicboxtheater.com as well. And we are reviewing the movies. Colin just told us about a film called A Bigger Splash with Ralph Fiennes, Tilda Swinton, and Dakota Johnson. Was not crazy about it. And Eric, what did you think?
It fell even flatter for me, and the inescapable fact that I kept thinking about after leaving the movie was that it felt like I had seen that particular movie about 8 times in the past, you know, whether it be a swimming pool or by the sea or, you know, even something like Match Point. It just seemed like it's, even though I know that it's actually, I think it's actually a remake of a French film from the 70s, I think, it's, you know, which I haven't seen. You couldn't escape the fact that it seemed like every beat in the film was leading towards, you know, this third act that was going to sort of disrupt everything, but it doesn't really disrupt anything because we don't really care about these characters up to that point. They're either, you know, you have one character who's completely obnoxious in Ralph Fiennes, and you have Dakota Johnson as sort of this mysterioso, you know, beauty who likes, you know, be in bikinis and as little close as possible. And then Tilda Swinton actually gives the most interesting performance in the movie just because she doesn't, pretty much can't talk. She has to just whisper and do, you know, just, you know, throat sounds and things. So that at least that's somewhat different. But everything else about the movie, just kind of sits there, and just kind of like Colin said, you're wondering, why are we watching these characters? What are the, you know, this movie isn't really working as drama. It doesn't really work as a thriller. It's certainly not working in any sort of satiric fold. I've not been a fan of this Matthias Schoenaerts for some time now. Every time he shows up in a movie, he just completely just kind of lies there. And particularly in this movie, when he's supposed to be the straight man, and he's straighter than any straight man that I've ever seen. So next to Swinton and Fiennes, you know, doing interpretive dance to Emotional Rescue, there's just nothing in this film to sort of walk out with any sense of anything, any sense of joy, or just, you know, enjoying any kind of the weirdness of it. Just the sort of sometimes the operatic feel that it goes to sometimes. Just nothing about this film worked for me at all.
Okay. It's too bad. I find the director interesting. He did a movie called I Am Love with Tilda Swinton, which I thought was really great, and I thought she was great in that too. But I will say this. This is the guy that's doing the Suspiria remake. And three of the four cast members are in the Suspiria remake. They said they had such a great time working on this movie that Dakota Johnson, Tilda Swinton, and Ralph Fiennes are all in the Suspiria remake.
Well, I could see that working better than this.
Okay,
because
Suspiria
is already a weird movie to begin with.
No, it is, but that's why there's, I mean, I just, the idea of remaking Suspiria, even when it was going to be David Gordon Green, which is weird, is a bad idea. It's what are they going to do? Why? It's such a singular, weird vision. You know what I mean? Like, nobody but Argento could make that movie. And I know this guy's made some weird movies. And, you know, it's an interesting, some interesting casting choices, I guess. I don't know. I just think it's a bad idea all the way around.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, that's a bigger splash. So, no. All right. Eric, why don't you tell us about The Family Fang?
Okay, well, this is the most recent directorial effort of Jason Bateman, who also stars in the film as him and his sister, played by Nicole Kidman, as children were used to be forced, in a way, to take part in these elaborate scams that were put on by their parents, played by Christopher Walken and who plays the mother?
Well, the mother, the older version of the mother, is Marianne Plunkett.
Marianne Plunkett, okay.
But in the flashbacks, it's Catherine Hahn.
That's what I was
right.
thinking of.
And Jason Butler Harner played the younger versions
of Walken, right.
and Marianne Plunkett. Yeah,
right. So his parents, their parents. Called this basically performance art, and they were sort of known for videotaping these things and showing them off. They were just sort of the jackass of their day, in a way. And now that the kids are grown up, and Nicole Kidman has become a famous actress, Jason Bateman's character has been, you know, kind of a lukewarm novelist. Things have never, you know, never quite gone his way. And then after he suffers a really bad accident on a journalist gig, he ends up in the hospital and ends up reuniting with everyone in the family. And Christopher Walken and their parents try to get them to go on another new scheme. And the kids, you know, now the adults, don't really want to participate. It doesn't really go well. And Walken's character is obviously very distraught and very disappointed in his children. Next thing you know, they're staying at their parents' house, sort of, you know, take some time away. They receive a phone call from the police saying that their parents have gone missing and may even be presumed dead. So this sort of sets them off on a bit of a mystery to figure out whether or not a scam is being pulled on them. And things that they find around their house that might actually clue them into bits of their childhood that might have formed their adulthood. So this is kind of a weird departure from Bad Words, Bateman's first feature, and is really, you know, trying to tackle some really potentially interesting things about what exactly constitutes art, as well as this really sort of horrific family dynamic with the Christopher Walken character. And it was kind of a mixed bag for me watching the film. I think, when the film is actually more comedic, it was actually working a bit better. And I think sometimes when it is trying to tackle some of these issues, it's kind of a lukewarm reception. But I actually really like the cast in the film. I think Bateman and Kidman are really good together. Walken, it just seems, it's the kind of role that Walken is sort of born to play in a way. And the more you sort of discover about who this guy is and what his philosophies are, that stuff became more interesting to me. I don't think it's a great film, but I had an interesting time watching it. So I give it kind of a slight recommendation.
Yeah, I got to say, there are things about this movie that I loved. There are certain things about it that I loved. The performances are really great, and the structure of the movie is a little bit chaotic.
Yes.
It starts out as a flashback, and then it moves forward 3 months to what happened, and then it goes back in time, and every once in a while it just goes back, and then there's this videotape that they cut to, like a documentary that they cut to a few times.
Right.
That's not introduced till the final third of the movie, but they use clips from it throughout the movie. So the structure of it is a little strange. But overall, there are things in this movie that I absolutely loved. I thought the score, Carter Burwell did the score.
Mm-hmm.
The score is great. Use of music is great. The first bit that they do where they do the fake bank robbery with the gunshots and stuff.
Yes.
They used I've Seen All Good People by Yes, and it's used beautifully. And the dynamic between Nicole Kidman and Jason Bateman, who I think are too old for the roles, that's just me. But their dynamic is great. Like these two actors should not be brother and sister ever. But I totally bought it. And there were funny things in the movie, and I like the directorial flourishes that Bateman has. I think Bateman's become a really good filmmaker. I just thought the movie hopped around too much in terms of structure, and it was a little jarring at times. I thought Harris Yulin shows up late in the film. I thought he was great. Like, his scenes, I thought, were hysterical.
Mm-hmm.
Got to say, the final part of the movie where the whole mystery comes together just gets completely absurd. Like, what happens at the end of the movie? And obviously, I wouldn't give anything away. But it also, the way they discover what happens, it involves a CD. It was just such an easy way. Like, you would think that Walken's character would cover his ass. Do you know what I mean? Like, it just seemed like, oh, because of this CD, now we're going to be able to discover more about these guys.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seemed really simple and rushed, for a movie that kind of took its time setting everything up. But I'm recommending it, too, because I think it's really a well-made movie. It's interesting. It's a very unusual movie. I've not read the book. And again, as you mentioned, all the performances in this movie are really, really terrific. It does have interesting ideas of what constitutes art and what doesn't. You'll go back and look at this and go, oh, was Andy Kaufman a jerk or was he an artist? Or
exactly.
Was Tom Green good at what he did or was he a jerk? Or is that art?
Mm-hmm.
And I for one do think it is. That's just me. But I thought that was an interesting thing. And again, I think Bateman's become a good filmmaker, and I just look forward. I like him in everything. So, but I just thought the wrap up was too quick, and the plot hole at the end was just too big for me to.
Yeah.
But I'm still recommending it though. All right, Eric, Colin, hang on, guys. And it's the Monday Morning Movie Reviews on WGN. Welcome back, everybody. It is the Movie Reviews, and we've got some more to review for you. Eric Childress, Colin Suter from eFilmCritic.com, RogerEbert.com, and more. And, of course, the Chicago Film Critics Association. Join me each week to talk about the new movies, and we are in the middle of reviewing the new movies. We'll also talk about the box office, as we do every Monday morning. My dad will also call in and tell a joke, because it's a jokey, jokey, jokey time on Monday morning. Our phone number and text number, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Also, check us out on Facebook at facebook.com/NickDShow, and you can follow us on Twitter at NickDShow. All right, let's get back to it. Eric and Colin, welcome back, guys.
Hello.
All right, Eric, tell us about High Rise.
Okay, this is based on the J.G. Ballard novel from the 1970s, I believe.
Yep.
And it stars Tom Hiddleston as a doctor or physiologist or something that moves into this really big, this giant high-rise tower in London. that is very unique. Unique for a reason, in that the higher you go up in the tower, obviously the better job and the more wealth you actually have. Maybe that's not so unique, but clearly you see this sort of the incarnation for what they're going for, sort of a sociological satire in a way. Mm-hmm. So he moves in, and he begins to meet all various tenants in the building. There's a single mom played by Sienna Miller and her son. And there's also a guy played by Luke Evans and his wife, Elizabeth Moss, who is pregnant. They live a little bit lower down in the building. As the movie goes along, we begin to see the sort of the strife that is beginning to develop between the haves and the have-nots, in a way. Elaborate parties going on up top, and the Luke Evans character begins to get increasingly annoyed by some of the goings-on in the building. The architect of the building, of course, lives at the top floor, is played by Jeremy Irons. And as the movie goes along, it becomes this sort of rise of anarchy in a way, and that is also predicated by a flashback that we see what may have actually become of this high rise in a few months from when the story begins. So, even though this is a book that took place in the 70s, one could easily describe this as sort of the upright Snowpiercer in a way. But with a remarkably different tone. Obviously, Snowpiercer was a really crazy science fiction action picture, and this is going more for a satiric tone. The problem is that this film is so overstuffed with characters who are not given enough time to really be fleshed out a bit. Once again, Elizabeth Moss is completely wasted in this film, which is really unfortunate. And it's got a lot of really good people in it. Even Luke Evans is actually surprisingly good in the film. But it never seems to find the voice that it's going for. It never really gets to the kind of fever pitch satire that we'd be expecting with something like this. Many times it feels like a movie that maybe David Cronenberg would have done in the 70s in sort of a Shivers kind of way. And you kind of wish that this movie was made, 30 years ago under, the eye of a Cronenberg. But it's been made by a director named Ben Wheatley, who has developed quite a cult following on the film festival circuit. He was responsible for movies like Down Terrace and Kill List, Sightseers, and a couple other ones. And he's a director that I've never really gotten in touch with. I've never quite found his work that fascinating and interesting. It seems like he's trying to play to that crowd in a way, just be quirky enough and not really flesh out his story motivations and everything. And it just every movie of his comes up flat, including Kill List, which was a film that has a lot of potentially really fun ideas to it, but is so telegraphed that by the time it gets to its sort of its Twilight Zone-ish ending, you've seen it coming a mile away. But with High Rise, you really don't care how everything's going to turn out. It doesn't reach a level of entertainment. It doesn't really work as satire, and it doesn't really work as drama. I was left cold by the entire enterprise.
Wow. All right. Now I've read the book. I happen to be a really big fan of Ballard, and so I read the book, and it's a pretty faithful adaptation of the book. It is a little stuff. They had to cut some stuff out and combine some stuff in it. But I think it captures the tone of the book really, really well. And it also, I think all the acting in the movie is good. I don't think Elizabeth Moss is wasted. I think she's got some really great moments in this movie. And Luke Evans is great. Luke Evans is phenomenal in this movie. I really thought he was great. He was perfectly cast, I thought. Hiddleston does a nice job with it. I thought the tone veered between there were moments in this movie where I just flat out laughed out loud, especially when, anybody goes up to visit Jeremy Irons in his penthouse, which is just the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen. His wife has horses and stuff on the in the penthouse apartment. Just very when the society starts to crumble, which is, essentially, Ballard wasn't really known for his subtlety in terms
nope.
of No, I mean, and I've, you know, Cronenberg, you mentioned Cronenberg. Cronenberg directed a movie called Crash that was based on his book, a book that I love, and also not a very subtle, not a very subtle movie as to what that thing was about.
Nope.
And so, but I thought it had a really nice tone to it. I thought it built nice. I thought it built really nicely. I thought Hiddleston's performance was really great. By the time he's beating the crap out of people in a grocery store because he wants a can of paint, I was laughing my, my head off. There are little things in the movie, like speaking of the grocery store, because everything is contained inside this high rise. People don't even have to leave the high rise if they don't want to. It's just this little world that they can stay in. Where the have-nots are on the bottom floors and the haves are on the top floors, and it's all it's obviously supposed to represent society. But by the time, you know, there's like garbage bags and things are on fire and everything is just turned to havoc, and Jeremy Irons is walking around with blood all over him and he's got a cane, and this is like one of the weirdest and juiciest crazy roles that Jeremy Irons had in a long time. He's perfectly cast in it, and of course it's going to bring to mind Cronenberg when you cast like Jeremy Irons in something like this. I thought when it worked on, it fired on all cylinders, I think. And there are times there are slow spots in it. I thought it was interesting, the screenwriter, and I can't remember her name right now, who adapted the...
Amy Jump, and it's Wheatley's wife, actually.
Oh, it's Wheatley's wife. Okay, well, she adapted the book, and I think she made a couple of very weird and interesting choices, where she took Ballard's prose in which he is describing... Because he's such a in that regard, Ballard was an amazing writer in that regard. Like his descriptions of places, his descriptions of things, his description of people, and she took that prose and made it into dialogue for some of the main characters, particularly Hiddleston. He's got a lot of the narration that actually is used as dialogue, and I thought that was an interesting approach. Sometimes it didn't work, but sometimes it did, and it added that voice. You know, that Ballard's very distinctive voice. So as a fan of J.G. Ballard, as a fan of the book, I really liked it. I thought it was good. And I don't know how people who haven't read the book, you're obviously, Eric, you haven't read the book.
No.
And it left you cold. I'd be really curious to see what people think of this movie had they knowing nothing about the book. Because as a Ballard fan, I think they captured it pretty nicely. And this is the third really good movie based on a J.G. Ballard book. A guy who some people think... And I was one of these guys who thought his books were unfilmable, absolutely unfilmable. But, you know, Spielberg did an unbelievable job with Empire of the Sun, and it's a terrific movie. It's one of my favorite Spielberg films. And obviously introduced the world to Christian Bale. God bless him. I thought Cronenberg did an amazing job with Crash. I love that movie, and I love the book. And I thought this guy did a formidable job with this. You know, he's written – Ballard wrote a ton of weird sci-fi books – that have that satirical weirdness to them. And I would love to see somebody just go, you know, let's just keep making Ballard books into movies. And so far, three very difficult books to make into a movie and three very good movies as far as I'm concerned. So anyway. All right, you guys, hang on. Okay. Yeah. And when we come back, Colin, you'll tell us all about Money Monster. And we will review it right here on the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. All right, we're back. Yeah, Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower, 312-981-7200 for talk and text, and it's Eric Childress, Colin Suter, and I reviewing the new movies, and we will also talk about box office with Eric as well, and we welcome you guys back.
Okay. Oh.
So, Money Monster is the last one we're going to review this morning, and Colin, tell us about Money Monster.
All right. Well, this stars George Clooney as the host of a TV show that is pretty much a take on Jim Cramer's show on CNBC. He has all the stupid gimmicks and the props and sound effects, and you know it's pretty unwatchable. Considered a stock market whiz. His show is produced by Julia Roberts and directed by Julia Roberts, and it appears that they're in for you know a normal show that airs live all over the world until strange young man played by Jack O'Connell gets onto the set and basically with a gun in his hand hijacks the show and takes the host at gunpoint, makes him wear a vest that's a bomb, and suddenly the feds and the SWAT teams are, you know, have to try to find a way to infiltrate the show and
it's up to Julia Roberts to call the shots, not just with the cameras, but with the activities surrounding this personal hostage crisis. Jack O'Connell's character lost $80,000 on a bad investment tip from Clooney's show and now wants a valid answer as to how this could have happened. And so the movie investigates that as well. So this is a movie directed by Jodie Foster. It's kind of an unusual kind of film for her to direct. It is, you know, very much a thriller with, of course, a, you know, sort of a political slant on it, too. The casting of George Clooney doesn't surprise me given the material. I like George Clooney, but, you know, when he is in a movie like this, or if he usually one that he's directing, this is the kind of film he would direct, you know, like Monument Men and Good Night and Good Luck. Usually it has a message to it that's laid on pretty thick, and it's usually a message that is a little too obvious to be interesting and kind of talks down to the audience in a way. And I feel like this is that kind of film. I think it's, you know, entertaining enough, I guess, on a surface level. Jodie Foster, I think, does a pretty decent job on a, you know, technical level directing a thriller like this. But I always just feel like it's a movie that is sort of preaching to the choir, as Clooney often likes to do. And so, I don't know, the movie didn't reach me, I think, the way it wanted to, because I just kind of thought, well, yeah, obviously. That was kind of my thought throughout the whole thing. So I can't quite recommend it, but I don't think it's a bad movie. I just think its message is just laid on a little too thick for my liking.
Okay. All right, Eric.
Yeah.
For about 10 minutes in this movie, everyone that's putting it together gets it and really sort of gets what they want to say about the media and television shows like this and journalism. For about a 10-minute stretch, including one really funny bit towards the very end after everything's been wrapped up and we see this viral video that's been created, which is a hilarious... And here's the best part about that is that, one, it's hilarious, but you're not really supposed to laugh.
Yeah.
And the fact that I laughed really hard at it, mm-hmm. and then I went, oh...
Yeah.
So like that, and there's like a 10-minute stretch just after the hostage crisis gets going where you get the sense that this is a movie that's supposed to be about journalism asking the hard questions and what happened to the journalists that asked the hard questions. Now, Colin mentioned Good Night and Good Luck, and that was obviously the film that Clooney directed about Edward Murrow. And that film, you know, that's precisely what that film was about. And here we have this era, the 24-hour news cycle, where news has become entertainment and news has become, you know, sort of bought and paid for with ratings and things like that. And when this movie is on point for a brief period of time, it's very involving. But it's only about 10 minutes because the rest of the movie becomes this pretty, on one half, it becomes a very pretty generic thriller. A pretty well-paced one at that. I give Jodie Foster some credit for that. But just a very generic, hostage thriller with sort of some echoes of Inside Man thrown in just for good measure. And then on top of that, when the film decides it actually wants to, like, hey, we're going to do big boy journalism for a second, it's completely ludicrous, even more ludicrous than the ending of The Family Fang that – you know, that these people can put this entire story together, but just by calling a few hackers across the world and putting everything together, it's completely not believable. I would have rather seen a more cynical approach that, you know, they try, but they fail, that kind of stuff. And also, you know, does the network not bother to call anyone when there's a live hostage crisis on the air? It just seems like it's Julia Roberts calling the shots and no one bothers to go like, hey, maybe you should take this off the air. If they did, I don't even remember that part. But the performances are fine. I think Jack O'Connell lays it on a little bit thick with his accent, his New York accent at times. There's a really hilarious scene where basically the only time I think anyone is going to have sympathy with this character, because I think he's kind of a flawed antagonist to begin with, is the scene where his girlfriend.
It's my favorite scene in the movie.
Yeah,
it's my favorite scene in the movie, and Emily Mead.
Yeah.
Is the awesome? Like she's just got one scene and kills.
Yeah.
Absolutely kills in that scene.
And in this era that we're in right now, where there's this really stupid anti-man thing going on, where men feel threatened by women and stuff like that.
Yeah.
See the post-reaction of that scene, where every man in America completely sympathizes with this guy now because he got his girlfriend bitched him out on television.
Right.
It's really funny. And there's also another really funny bit when Clooney asked the world to basically save his life.
Yeah.
That the culmination of that scene is really funny, and it made me think like there's a deeper satire going on here that then got replaced by a really generic thriller, and it kind of disheartened me the longer it went on. I can't recommend it either.
Well, I'm recommending it, and because I think it's first of all, I think Jodie Foster directed the hell out of it. I think it's a beautifully made film. I think it's a beautifully made film of a script that continuously gets more ludicrous as it goes on. I mean, it just by the ending, it's absurd. You know, like 90% of the stuff that happens in the last third of this movie would never happen on the planet Earth. And you're right. I mean, you're like, you know, when they bring it, when the thing starts to move mobile, like when they actually are leaving the studio, it's at that point where the movie is completely ludicrous. But I was still on board, and I still think that Jodie Foster, even as the plot got more absurd, still had her foot on the pedal, and it was good. I think she directed the hell out of this movie and made it, I think, very entertaining. I think George Clooney, you know, he's doing the George Clooney thing. I think Julia Roberts and him are really good. I think O'Connell is good. He does do the accent a little bit heavy. And like, as we mentioned before, Emily Mead steals the scene she's in. I thought Lenny Venito was great as the cameraman. Giancarlo Esposito is in it. I think he has some nice moments. And you have McNulty. You have McNulty and Sabatka.
Yeah. Clearly a fan of The Wire, Jodie Foster.
Oh, no question about it. But you know, yeah, as it gets more absurd, I was like, okay, whatever. And then, you know, you got that punchline at the end that you mentioned, Eric, where it kind of brought it all back for me.
Okay.
So I think it's a fine movie. You know, I think it's entertaining. It's not great, but I thought Jodie Foster did a remarkable job directing it. I thought it was a fine piece of Hollywood entertainment. It says a little bit. It could have said more about its topic, about its subject matter. But I think it's a pretty entertaining thriller. So I'm going to recommend it. So, all right. Next week, you guys have your critic, Chicago Critics Film Festival. We got the Angry Birds movie.
Yep.
We've got Neighbors 2.
Yep.
And Nice Guys.
The Nice Guys.
Yeah, with Ryan Gosling and Russell Crowe.
Mm-hmm.
All right, cool. All right, Colin, thanks, man.
Alrighty.
All right, we'll talk to you next week, and that's Colin. And Eric, hang on, because we'll take a break, and we'll come back, and we'll talk about the box office. All right, and we will do that after we take this break. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we are live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. And the movie reviews, we went through them. The Darkness is terrible. The Family Fang, I'm kind of recommending. Eric was a little bit mixed on it as well. Being Charlie, Eric did not recommend that. A Bigger Splash, neither Colin nor Eric recommended that. High Rise, Eric didn't recommend. I am recommending it. And The Money Monster, all of us, Eric and Colin not recommending it, and I am. But everybody was kind of borderline on that one. All right, so let's get to the box office. Eric, of course, Captain America.
Mm-hmm.
Civil War, $72.5 million this weekend. And was that about where everybody expected it to be?
Well, it's sort of in line with your big blockbuster numbers. It was a little lower than I was expecting it to be, just based on critical response and what I thought word of mouth would be a little bit better on it. It doesn't really say anything about word of mouth. It really just kind of falls in line with the sort of the 59% drop average that a lot of these big opening weekends that we've seen have done.
Right.
So it doesn't really say anything about it. And the fact is that the movie this week is going to be crossing $1 billion.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, $940 million as of this weekend.
So in like, 3 weeks?
Yeah.
It's going to hit $1 billion. And Batman's not even there. The Batman Superman movie's not even there yet, and it's been out for double the time.
Yeah, and then Batman vs. Superman is pretty much done world, especially worldwide box office, it's sort of settled in around 865 mm-hmm. million, maybe a little bit more.
Right.
So it's done.
Okay. All right. And so the total right now for Captain America is 295 million domestically.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Jungle Book is in second. Boy, this thing is just a monster.
Yeah.
I mean, my God, 17.7 million.
Yeah, I mean, the drops week to week are insane. I don't think it's dropped more than 44% in any week that's been out. Mm. And this movie is now over, I think, $825 million worldwide. So it's going to pass Batman vs. Superman soon enough.
Wow.
And Disney is actually on its way to having the first year, very possibly have the first year where they have four movies in release that grossed $1 billion worldwide.
That's unbelievable.
No other studio has pulled that off. I mean, clearly they're going to do it with Civil War. Zootopia is at like $970 million right now.
Yeah.
So it's right there. Jungle Book's at $825 million. And look what they got coming out. They got Finding Dory coming out.
Yeah.
They got another Star Wars movie coming out.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Yeah, unbelievable. The movie we were just reviewing, Money Monster, $15 million. How's that? That's not a great opening, is it?
It's not a great opening, but I think it's a little better than I was expecting. I was sort of expecting more around 12, 13.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Clooney, you know, I mean, he's certainly a name. He's only had 10 movies that have ever opened to over $15 million. So this is sort of right in line
yeah.
with, you know, sort of, you know, your non-oceans, your non-gravity type, event type movie.
Yeah, right.
And you know, it's a big hit for Jodie Foster, who's never had a wide release like Money Monster. And the highest grossing film she's ever directed was $25 million. That was Little Man Tate.
Mm-hmm.
So this movie's going to make more than that, but it's probably going to top out somewhere between $35 and $40 million.
Yeah, and I mean, this is her fourth movie as a director. I think she's terrific. I think she's a great director.
Well, she's a treasure as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, even if a misstep that I think she does in Money Monster, I think is maybe the least interesting movie that she's directed, you know, she's still Jodie Foster.
Yeah, she's great on both sides of the camera as far as mm-hmm. I'm concerned. She is. You're right. She's a treasure. Number four, The Darkness, with 5.1 million. There were like eight people in the theater when I went.
Yeah, I'm surprised it made that much. I really am. I didn't know if this thing was gonna outgrow Green Inferno, which only made $7 million.
Yeah. Well, I guess maybe
one ad for this thing.
Yeah. No. I mean, they didn't really advertise a lot for it. But maybe it's just that the genre fans were hungry for something.
Possibly.
Because
yeah.
There hasn't been a horror movie out in a long time.
No, I mean, and it's like, you know, a lot of those, you know, they probably already saw Civil War, maybe twice already.
Yeah, right.
And it's like, they're probably not going to go see Money Monsters. So, well, you know, okay, we'll go see this.
Mm-hmm. All right. Mother's Day, 3.2 million, and that dropped 70%.
Well, it didn't have the Mother's Day holiday.
It didn't have Mother's Day this week, that's right.
Yeah.
Number six, the aforementioned Zootopia. Jeez, man, this thing.
Crazy, isn't it?
It's nuts, man.
Awesome.
$2.8 million, and it's been out for, what, 11 weeks?
Since March. The first week of March it came out, and now it's into the summer, second week of the summer season, and it's still in the top six.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
It really is amazing. It's a good movie, too.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and let's see. Number seven, The Huntsman, Winter's War. Boy, oh boy, $44 million in 4 weeks.
One of the bombs of the year.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Number eight, Keanu. That one, you know, the Key and Peele fans went.
Yeah.
Nobody else did.
No.
So, which is too bad because I think it's hilarious. Number nine, Barbershop, The Next Cut, with 51 million total so far. That's pretty good.
Yeah, it's kind of finishing up where everyone has sort of expected it to be.
Okay. And then number 10 is The Boss.
Yeah.
Up to 61 million.
Yeah, the numbers don't get very sexy once you get past like Jungle Book.
Right. No, they don't. And what about what about something like in the, you know, these independent little movies? Like, how is like Sing Street doing?
Not good.
No.
Weinstein blew it. Weinstein really blew it with that film. I mean, the ads were there like the first week it was in limited release, but they didn't release it right. They didn't. I think they released it the wrong time. I think they should have waited until sometime in the summer to release it the way they did Begin Again. Mm. I mean, I know it doesn't have a cast and whatnot, and you're going purely on, you know, the strength of a, you know, fun little, you know, music story. So, I mean, you can't expect a whole lot, but I don't know. I think that sometimes they give up on stuff too quickly. And I know for a fact that there are some theaters around Chicago that even have trouble, you know, working with Weinstein to bring, when they want to bring movies into their theaters. Mm. So
it's really
unfortunate.
It is, because it's a terrific movie.
Yep.
It's out there, folks. You know, I mean, it's only in a few theaters, but it's got a wider release than it did when we first reviewed it.
Mm-hmm.
So find Sing Street and see it. Now, what about now, next week? Do we get The Lobster? Is that going to finally open
yes.
in Chicago?
Yes, The Lobster is opening in Chicago.
Is it just? I'm assuming it's just going to be at one theater.
Probably. Probably. I previewed it. That I saw that at Toronto as well.
Oh yeah, no, I remember yeah. you talking about it, and I'm really looking forward to it because you know I love Colin Farrell, and
it you should
just,
be.
It sounds weird,
mm-hmm.
and so I can't wait to see that. That'll be out next week. And now I do want to say this. Now when I went to go see Money Monster I went with my folks on Saturday to see Money Monster, who by the way they loved it.
Okay.
So we go see Money Monster, and I never thought I would see this, but there is a, you know, they have the big cardboard stands.
Yeah.
You know, people are taking pictures with, you know, they'll stand with the Avengers and they'll take pictures with them.
Yes.
And then like, oh, let's stand between Russell Crowe and Ryan Gosling.
Right.
You know, that's cool. There is a giant cardboard lobby stand for the Swiss Army Man.
Okay.
Which I just find incredible
there's a giant cardboard lobby thing.
It was right next to the Nice Guys at the theater I went to, and I saw it. I was like, you gotta be kidding me. And it's him riding him like a surfboard.
Yeah.
And I was like, are you, this movie about this guy stranded on a desert island with a farting corpse,
yeah,
this has got a giant lobby stand next to a movie with Ryan Gosling.
That, you know, man, I'm so curious to see how A24 is going to handle that movie.
Yeah.
Because we lobbied hard, actually, to bring it to for our festival. We really wanted this movie.
Yeah.
And it just didn't work out. So I'm really curious to see how, I mean, clearly they're trying things with, you know, The Witch, and you know they opened Green Room a little bit wide after a few limited weekends.
Yeah,
and and this one, you know, it's, you know, it's Paul Dano, it's Daniel Radcliffe, and it's an out there movie.
Well,
it really,
you know,
is.
I saw the when you described it, you reviewed it. You saw it at Sundance. Okay,
mm-hmm.
You reviewed it. I was like, okay, this sounds fantastic.
Yeah,
to me, and. Then I saw the trailer, and the trailer is phenomenal.
It's a great trailer.
It is a great trailer, and and I can't wait to see this thing. But I got to tell you, I was blindsided by the fact that there was a giant lobby cardboard stand.
Can you, like, sit in it and take pictures and
You could stand right next to it and get your little picture taken while Paul Dano is riding on Daniel Radcliffe.
He's riding a corpse
through the water. Yeah, that's the big
point.
I thought that was pretty great. So
yeah, people, you know, obviously it is going to open in Chicago. I think it opens July 1st in Chicago.
Cool.
Look out for it, because, you know, if you're looking for little hidden gems this summer, that certainly is one of them.
Okay, cool. All right. Well, listen, man, good luck on Friday.
Thank you.
We're going to talk to you guys. I think you guys are just going to make like a brief appearance on Monday morning. Just to talk about the festival, because you guys are going to be busy for the whole week.
Yeah.
And then I think Jim is going to come in. Laskowski is going to come in. We'll do the full reviews with me and Jim.
Okay.
All right. And then, but have a great time, man. And it's, once again, ChicagoCriticsFilmFestival.com.
Thanks, man.
All right, Eric. Take care, buddy.
Okay.
All right. There's Eric Childress. He'll be back with us next week. And the Chicago Critics Film Festival kicks off Friday at the Music Box from the 20th through the 26th. Get your tickets and your schedule at MusicBoxTheater.com.